The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
So osmotic demyelination syndrome being encompassing of central pontine myelinosis, the classic term, or extrapontine myelinosis.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Sodium Correction Rates and Associated Outcomes Among Patients with Severe Hyponatremia, a Retrospective Cohort Study. Joining us on the podcast is the first author of this paper, Dr. Dustin Mark, who is an emergency medicine and critical care physician at Kaiser Permanente. We believe you will find this podcast interesting and hope that it helps you better understand how we take care of severe hyponatremia. Well, Dustin, thank you so much both for doing this study and being willing to be on the podcast. I found it fascinating because I love studies that take what we commonly think and challenge them and show that maybe our thought process wasn't exactly right. So that's where I think we are. Why don't you start by telling us the background of why you did this analysis?
You know, I work as an emergency physician and a critical care physician. So I see a spectrum of hyponatremia presentations. And at my hospital locally, we had some fairly rigid policies about absolute numbers and locations of care in particular, irregardless of symptoms. Sometimes it felt like we were overdoing it, I should say, in patients that were asymptomatic and tightly controlling their sodium levels to almost to the point that we seemed like we were chasing our tails. Mm-hmm. And as I started looking at this a little bit more, and I think with, a couple of the papers that came out in 2023 that were larger studies and gained a bit of press, I hadn't paid a great deal of attention to it in the past, but it started to feel like we were basing decisions on older data with limited subsets of patients that, maybe this needed another look. And I had the opportunity to seek internal funding and use, our rather large data set that had been accumulated internally over 20 plus years within, various sites and use our analysts to dig into that. And, the other part of it was that I knew that there was a lot of practice variation within our 21 hospitals. And so it created the milieu that I figured we could find enough of representation of patients that were treated one way or the other, and not particularly driven by their characteristics, but rather just local practice variation and create a setting where we could investigate whether there was a natural experiment going on and that, validate some of these prior findings with a little bit more granular data.
So who are the patients in the study?
So we looked at anyone who came in through the emergency department that had a initial sodium of 120 or less. We did exclude anybody who had hyperglycemia that might be causing pseudohyponatremia, but otherwise it was fairly permissive in the admission criteria.
Okay, so this is something that scares emergency room physicians, critical care physicians, and every other physician who sees a sodium less than 120. So it's a great group to study, and that's why this is such a valuable study. How'd you measure the outcomes, and what were the groups that you compared?
So the outcomes were inpatient mortality, 90-day mortality, and based in part on a recent study of ICU patients with similar criteria, we looked at neurologic outcomes more as a syndromic diagnosis, be it altered mental status, paresis, demyelination, seizures, but to try to differentiate symptoms that were due to the hyponatremia rather than those that developed after the treatment, we exclude anyone who had a past diagnosis in the past 12 months of those groupers, and then look to see that the diagnosis was entered on hospital day 3 or later, out to 90 days. And so in that sense, we're trying to define a delayed neurologic diagnosis that presumably is not present on admission. There's some caveats there, but I think it leans towards biasing towards sicker patients who might be more likely to be faster or corrected more quickly. And so it felt like something that if there were truly adverse events that were coming up with slow correction, which would be the hypothesis, then we would pick that up and feel fairly confident in the results. And so the comparisons we looked at were slow correction that we defined as less than 8 milliequivalents per liter over 24 hours. And we didn't pick just a fixed time point. We looked at any measurement of 120 or subsequent measurements below 120, and then looked at the most proximate measurements that were about 24 hours away, plus minus 6 hours, and then averaged those together using a weighted formula. And the next category was 8 to 12, and then greater than 12. And so we just took the highest correction within a 24-hour period. So we weren't, wedded to the first 24-hour period that came up, which is what was done in other studies. And we were trying to be permissive to say, all right, a lot of times when you look at case series of patients with ODS, they will dig in and say, well, at this point, they did correct by over 10 or over 12. It wasn't necessarily their first 24 hours, but later. So we tried to be permissive and allow for any 24-hour period that might have come up, starting at where, people get concerned for correction rates, and moving forward.
Just for the purpose of the listeners, not everybody is familiar with the new terminology of ODS. Could you just explain that real quickly?
So osmotic demyelination syndrome, being encompassing of central pontine myelinosis, the classic term, or extrapontine myelinosis. And so, the classic paper in 1958, presented autopsy series of alcoholics who had large part of their pons missing, largely symmetric. And that's fairly pathognomonic for the demyelination that you see with sodium correction or in patients that present with severe hyponatremia. But over time, it became clearer that there were extrapontine manifestations, often in deep brain, basal ganglia, and thalamus, and sometimes they're asymmetric as well. So it really, part of the reason to use these clinical criteria was that the manifestations seem to be somewhat protean and probably are often missed or underappreciated, combined with the fact that a lot of patients can have subtle presentations and recover, relatively quickly. So I don't know that we have a great handle on the overall incidence, aside from, the classic devastating cases that we've all come across in our careers.
Right, that we give even extra weight to at all times.
Yes.
So this is a retrospective cohort study over a number of years. Could you discuss how many years and how you adjusted for the fact that it is retrospective?
Yes. So we looked, it was a 16-year look back from 2008 to 2023, the beginning to the end of those years. And the adjustment was done, that we have internally a validated system of looking at the acute laboratory parameters with imputation for missing values that predicts in-hospital mortality, but also 90-day mortality. The original construct that we used doesn't incorporate vital signs, so it's more geared towards 30 to 90-day mortality, and that was our primary outcome. And so that's a laboratory adjusted physiology score, or the LAPS score. We also, created Ehlers-Hauser scores, to adjust for inpatient mortality and comorbid outcomes. And site of admission, whether they went to the ICU or not, what was their principal diagnosis, which is, of course, an important confounding variable. Some people come in with sepsis, some people come with respiratory failure, severe pneumonia. toxicologic causes, malignancy, liver failure, heart failure, and all the key groupings that you think of that are associated with severe hyponatremia, and separated those out into their own, you know, covariate adjustments. And, you know, finally, we also focused on a past history of some of those key groupers, be it metastatic cancer, acknowledging that, you know, in at least in the most recent data, when you looked at the cause of death of people that were selected or corrected slowly, cancer often came up as a leading cause attributed on death certificates. So we wanted to see, you know, if we could control for metastatic cancer in terms of predicted 90-day mortality, liver disease, and CHF. We also looked at a primary diagnosis of hyponatremia, which accounted for about 50% of the population. And I'm blanking on other things, of course, year and adjusting for temporal trends. And medical center variation, knowing that there was some practice variation mm-hmm. between our centers. So all those were as fixed effects because we had enough of a large sample that we had enough outcomes to really model it fairly discreetly.
So I forgot approximately how many patients did you have in your final analysis?
So we end up, you know, one of the inclusion criteria was that you had, at least for the primary outcome of 90-day outcomes, that you had active health insurance coverage, so we could be sure that we were capturing events that occurred after hospitalization. So that group with active insurance was roughly 14,000.
It's a good number.
We also looked at big number, and, you know, with a fairly high mortality rate. You know, you're looking at 20 to 30% of those patients passing away within 90 days. And then for in-hospital outcomes, we were able to add another 2,000 patients.
Great. So tell us what you found, the results.
Well, in short, we found the same as other studies that have looked at this question. And, you know, that slower correction at less than 8 milliequivalents per liter for 24 hours was associated with a higher risk of death. And surprisingly, these delayed neurologic outcomes, you know, in terms of absolute differences, there was a 9% absolute difference between the fast group, which was greater than 12, and the slow group, which was less than 8 mm-hmm. in the composite of either death or delayed 90-day outcome. Most of that was driven by death. You know, it was 8% difference, but there was actually a 2%, you know, 1.7% that was statistically significant increased risk of delayed neurological events as well. We also looked at 48-hour correction rates, dichotomized as less than 18 or greater than equal to 18 per guidelines. And the signal was not as strong, but it was a similar trend, at least in the composite outcome. So it carried through, you know, and in multiple different ways we looked at it, we were able to adjust for predicted risk of death and use strata. So rather than looking at just discrete binary categorizations like sex or ICU admission or whatnot, we just created a composite risk of death index and stratified between four quartiles. And the absolute magnitude of the difference, of course, drops as your predicted risk of the outcome goes down, but the relative risk was really consistent across all those strata. So this speaks to the, you know, concern that we're really dealing with unmeasured confounding and that it's the underlying risk of death that's driving these associations. But whether we looked at people that were low risk or high risk of death, we really saw the same relative difference. So I think it's fairly convincing or concerning, depending on how you want to look at it, that we're not just dealing with unmeasured confounding here.
And I shared this with you ahead of time. It looked like the people who were above 12 in general did better, but then you put in something, once you get up to about 18 or 20, it gets worse.
Right.
But yet, I'm going to read your final recommendation, and then I want you to comment on why you chose that recommendation. Given that multiple studies with varying designs have reached similar conclusions, treatment guidelines for severe hyponatremia should be reexamined to allow for faster sodium correction, for example, 8 to 12 milliequivalents per liter in 24 hours, irrespective of presumed risk factors. So that's sort of one of the final statements of your wonderful paper. Why'd you pick that as opposed to a little bit faster, because a little bit faster seemed to even be better.
So we did model as a continuous variable the rate of change versus the risk of death, and it did nadir, honestly, around 15 to 20. And then there was a tail that it looked like it started to go back up, and there was a U-shaped association. And this is, it comports with animal evidence. A lot of the experimental evidence that looks at fast correction, really in the experimental settings, the correction rates were often 25, 30, 35 or greater over 24 hours. And that's where you really start to see this very high incidence of histopathologic changes at autopsy. But there are some studies where you're less, and the range is quite wide, but you're somewhere in this 10 to 20 range where you actually see a lower incidence, and then it goes back up when you go really slow. You do some correction, but not as fast, and you start to see more lesions. And so all that's to say is there is some evidence that, this nadir exists somewhere in that range, but we did not have, and this came up with in the editorial review, that we needed to be careful about really overstating where that inflection point was, because on the higher end of correction, we don't have as many data points. It really peters out there, and the confidence around those estimates gets much, much lower. And so, it felt a little bold, to be honest, to advocate for a higher rate when we don't have as much data there. I think we felt more comfortable with the medium versus slow comparison, also showing that there was a higher risk, and that being a starting point there. And as far as irrespective of risk factors, we did look for, the subgroup with the classic ODS risk factors in bulk, and couldn't find any evidence that they were at higher or lower risk of complications.
So is that
So
what you're doing now in your practice? If you're in the if you're in the ICU and get a patient at 115, are you going up 8 to 12 per day?
I will do that in my practice. And, frankly, that was my practice when I first started practicing. It was a 0.5 to 1 millicolor per liter hour correction. And, that I think that all made sense. We, as a group, we're a group of multi-specialty physicians that cover all the 21 hospitals, are in the process of, re-examining our guidelines. And as when this paper comes out, I'll present to our nephrologists first and see if we can come to consensus. But yeah, in my personal practice, I do think it's the right thing to do to not hold these patients in a hyponatremic state. I think that we underappreciate, the adverse consequences of sustaining that, and are maybe over reassured by animal models that, they don't have the same structure and susceptibility points. A lot of this data is based on rats. I found it as I was reviewing for, this upcoming talk, that, some of the larger animal studies that you look at, a lot of the subjects don't survive the induction of hyponatremia. You're trying to hold them in this severe hyponatremic state, and over half of the animals die before you can actually undergo the correction. And so, I don't know that we can extrapolate small mammal data to our practice settings with such confidence that we've been doing.
But I like that this comes in addition to other studies that have suggested the same findings that you have. It's always nice when there's several studies of different styles that keep coming up with the same thing. Well, I
Yes.
hope you're successful in your ideas and convincing others. I'm sure there'll be some debate about this when it comes out, and I look forward to that debate. But thank you so much for being on the podcast and for doing the study.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This interesting article focuses on the treatment of severe hyponatremia, which they define as less than 120 at admission. One of the important concepts is whether or not you're going to get more or less ODS, which is osmotic demyelination syndrome, which includes both pontine and extrapontine demyelination. They found that slow replacement patients were more likely to die and more likely to have delayed neurological events. They defined slow replacement as less than 8 milliequivalents per 24 hours. They also felt that the rate that seemed to be reasonable and at this time the best was between 8 and 12 milliequivalents per 24 hours, the medium response. This changes how I'm thinking about treating hyponatremia because this is different than what many people have recommended recently, but this also is consistent with other recent articles. I hope that listening to this podcast will help you think more seriously about the treatment of severe hyponatremia.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall